Hello and welcome to Better by the Minute Life with Becca. My name is Becca Dukes and I am excited to be able to bring to you additional information that empowers you to take control of your life and have a Better by the Minute life in all that you do. And this evening I have back with me Dr. Judy Reynolds. Now, tonight we are going to be talking about your pets. So we spend so much time, we put so much love into our pets. We want to make sure that we keep them around for as long as possible. And Dr. Judy Reynolds, her specialty is actually in nutrition, and not just nutrition, but going into the animal sciences of nutrition as well. Dr. Judy Reynolds, welcome to Better by the Minute Life with Becca. I am so excited to be having you here and discussing this topic because I don't know about you. Well, I do know about you, myself included. I spend more time and money on my animals sometimes than I do myself. Welcome, Dr. Judy, to Better by the Minute Life with Becca.
Thanks, Becca. Yes, it's so great to be here. And animals, pets, horses have been my life. So, the perfect topic, when you talk about having a better life, I can't imagine a life without pets. My mother gave me a pillow one time that said, life without horses? I don't think so. It was pretty cute. So that has been my life. And they really do. I mean, there are all kinds of scientific studies and everything that say that if you have a pet, you know, that unconditional love and all of that support and just the things that pets do. And the other thing to keep in mind is there are pets now that can tell if you have cancer, that tell if you're going to have a seizure. My grandson and I just watched some really good videos where it said pets rescued their owners in certain ways. Just, I can't imagine a world without our pets. So here we are.
Here we are. And Dr. Judy, share with us a little bit about your education and what makes you the perfect expert to be talking on this topic today.
Wow. Okay. Well, I grew up just a horse lover in a family that had no horses. I just loved horses. So I wanted to be a veterinarian. Well, things don't always work as we plan, as we know. So when I got out of high school, I had taken a lot of courses to help do that, but I just wasn't able to go. So I had started training and showing and riding horses when I was about 14. And I was in the horse industry actually for, it's got to be roughly 15, 16 years. After high school, and I had an injury to my neck and back to the point where I couldn't even ride for a year. And so I got started thinking, okay, I love the horses. I love what I'm doing, but it might be smart for me to get a regular job like a teacher and then do my animals in the summer and not do so much, have so much danger with it. Well, you know, it's a crazy thing because there are dangers involved in horses. There always will be. Things can happen. But anyway, that was my thought process after not being able to really even do my job for a year. I had two young kids and my husband worked all the time. I was home with the kids doing the construction business and raising the kids. So after getting injured like that, I actually went to college. There was a junior college that offered a scholarship for women who had been out of high school for 7 years or longer. They gave us one semester of tuition and books for free. Well, that was awesome. So I went there. It just so happened that junior college had several programs for nursing students. It happened to be our local area. So they had full classes. So they had, you know, some of the biology, biochemistry, things like that, but they also had human anatomy and physiology. Now we did not have humans to dissect. We did cats, but we did the official human anatomy and physiology. And I was able to do that. I focused on what makes things work because that was my fascination with horses, not just enjoying riding them, but I had the little visible horse model and things where I wanted to figure out, how do they run so fast? How do they do all these things? So physiology was a focus. Then I went on and I finished and got a bachelor's degree at a state university, St. Cloud State University in Minnesota, because that was local for me. And their focus there was a business school and a teaching school. So I got a degree in biology and secondary education and teaching and licensure to teach science from 7th through 12th grade. Being who I am and loving school as much as I did, after finishing that degree, I had the option of staying there, getting a master's and continuing teaching, but there were no horse courses, nothing with agriculture there. So I checked around and sure enough, I found three universities that had horse programs throughout the country. And because I was such a nerd and I had really good grades and everything, I got accepted at all of them. And I chose Texas A&M University, picked up my whole family, my husband, my two kids, and we moved to Texas. And in Texas, it's at College Station, Texas, where there is a medical library, veterinary college, veterinary library, all the animal science stuff. It's probably one of very few universities where nutrition for humans is within the College of Animal Science. So when you go there, you are an animal scientist. You're training to be an animal scientist, but they bring really good human nutrition people in. So my undergrad was already human. Then I go down to do animal and I still have human coming in. And I did animal science for a master's, which was amazing. I came into the second year of a project where they had started with 60 racehorses. They started as yearlings. I came in the second year when they were two-year-olds. And we actually spent almost a year feeding those horses three different amounts of a specific nutrient to decrease bone injuries and bone breaks. If you've ever seen a racehorse break a leg or something, it's catastrophic. It's horrible. So this was an FDA project. I got in with another person. The two of us did that project. There were 53 left after the first year. And that nothing happened to them. They were just mares and they wanted to raise foals out of them. So they took them out of the project. So we had 53 horses. We did one long distance race with each of them in groups up to four. And then we did 10 match races. So you're talking 53 horses, 11 times each one raced. We had to borrow a local racetrack. We had to hire jockeys from the track and everything and race these horses. And that was my master's degree. So I was very immersed in this. And again, it was nutrition. It was a nutrition focus, racing horses. I ran thousands of samples. I ran blood samples. I did heart rate, respiration, temperature, blood glucose, lactate, all these kinds of samples and wrote this all up. And that particular ingredient, it was called sodium zeolite A, which is an ionophore to help calcium get into the body. When we finished that, that was an FDA study, and they went on and went to use it for humans for osteoporosis. Now, I have not kept up with that. I graduated with that degree in 1993, but we do have a lot better treatments now and things for osteoporosis. But we also know within the industry that, yes, we can feed nutrients, make sure we meet all our nutrient needs, and we can help regenerate and make bones stronger. And back in the day when I was doing that research, we did not know that. We were not sure that that could be done. So that was an amazing thing. Then I went on and did another project, which was, it was more of a genetic diet interaction, which is actually what we call epigenetics, because there was this mutation that caused horses to get very sick, possibly fall down and die. But by feeding three different amounts of potassium in the diet, we were able to, on the lowest amount, we were able to actually prevent symptoms of that disorder. I mean, everything I've done has been both nutrition and minerals. Finished with that, my major professor told me about a position where a mineral company that focused on minerals for animals had been looking for a full-time equine nutritionist to help them to design a horse feeding program using their minerals, because of the work that I've done, my professor recommended me and I got that position. And that was the job, literally the job of a lifetime. Because here I am, and I'm an older person. I've already trained horses. I know the industry. I'm the kind of person that likes to go out and lead and do things. And I was able to spend 14 years going out. I developed products. I helped market them. I explained to salespeople about them, and it was perfect for me. And so I have all this background. The other thing is, by being at that job, I was able to interact with all of the other nutritionists, from dairy, poultry, beef, swine, pets, everybody, all of us together. One of the main things that happened there was natural source vitamin E, which is a big deal. But again, we're getting to the idea of pets. So our horses and our pets, when we look at the nutrition of our animals, we very carefully balance vitamins and minerals. There have been, I think, estimated 60 billion in research on animal nutrition that we can pull from. And what they do with animals is they can very precisely feed them and control all the conditions. For instance, if you're, let's say you're doing a lab study and you're using rats or something, you can control the temperature, the humidity, the lighting. You give them exactly what you want in the pellets, and you control all the variables, and you might give a little more or a little less of one nutrient. And then you'll find out what are the requirements. What happens to that animal without that nutrient? So that's very precise. That's what the animal industry brings to us. But with humans, we can't ethically, even if we could figure it out, we couldn't ethically take people and put them in a room and make them stay there and feed them exactly what we want and have the exact conditions. So we have to rely on things like the memory of the person. What did they eat? How much did they eat? When did they eat it? It's just completely different with human nutrition. So by having that background of animal nutrition, we can look more closely at human nutrition. And what I do is I use that philosophy when I look at research and things. I just assume immediately that whenever I read a paper on human nutrition, that all of the other variables were not controlled, because it's not possible. But the problem with that is, in the industry, you all know how many doctors are out there, how many diet programs are out there, how many recommendations are out there. And the problem is, you can go and cherry pick, and you can make a perfect cherry picked proof that a diet that's very restrictive, very specific, is the only way to go. And then you can take the opposite and prove that also, because you never control the rest of the variables. And what's basically missing in human nutrition is the vitamins and the minerals, specifically the minerals, because plants can make some vitamins, we can make some vitamins in our body, but there are essential nutrients, mostly minerals, that we have to get in our diet every day, that we put in the animal pellets, but we don't have a human pellet. We don't make sure we're getting them. So again, to be talking about human nutrition, to be talking about pet nutrition, it's really valuable to be able to look at both. And then just looking in the animal world, you've got, how many animals are there? I mean, I don't even know. But one of the most interesting things for me was comparative animal physiology and anatomy, because you have things like whales that can go underwater, withstand the pressure. There's a huge amount of pressure when you go down deep underwater, and they come up and breathe every once in a while and they're fine. And things like birds have to be light, so they have hollow bones, and they only develop one side of their reproductive tract, because they don't need to carry around two fully functional ovaries. They only need one. And if that one doesn't work, the other one steps in. I mean, there are just these amazing differences. And by having that in your mind, those differences, it gives you a different perspective on how will I look at what I personally want to eat or what I want to feed my pet. So that's kind of a long, convoluted way. But then I had to leave the job that I love, because my own health, I had been injured, as I said before. I had a major neck and back injury. And I was to the point where I wasn't able to get up and go and do a regular job. I had traveled a lot, done a lot of weekend work and things. I couldn't do it. So I had to retire from that and become a consultant. And then I found a doctor who had really pulled all this together by focusing on these essential nutrients. And basically, you know, we say 90, there are probably more, there may be more, but there are specific nutrients. And if we make sure that we get those, and then we also have to look at some things that we do or do not want to eat. And it's the same thing within the pet food. When we look at the pet food industry, look at it like any other industry. The pet food industry, the people that make pet foods and design them are trying to make money. They're an industry. They have that right. That's their job, to make money. So they're going to have options of ingredients to put into the foods. And what we have to think about is, you know, you have to trust a company. You have to be able to look at the labels on your on the pet foods. And then you have to say, okay, if I see chicken, is that a good food for my pet? For the most part, probably yes. If I see chicken byproduct, that could mean a lot of different things. And there are some other things within the animal industry that are interesting. For instance, on horse food labels, you have two choices. You can either list every single ingredient, or you can list the ingredients by categories. And this will make sense in a little bit more in a second. The categories are things like protein products, byproducts, forage products, grain products. And when you look at byproducts or you look at protein products, it's actually legal to put chicken feathers in as a protein. It's legal, but do you want it? I do not. So the way the animal food industry is set up, when they're making decisions on what they're going to put in the feed, there are cheap things. A cheap filler in horses is rice hulls. Now, rice hulls are not digestible. They're the really big part that comes off that you never see. Now, the rice bran is the brown part, and that's extremely nutritious. So that's a good thing to put in. But again, you learn which nutrients you want to see in the food or the feed, the dog food or the horse feed. Which nutrients do you want to see in there and which you not want to see in there? And to kind of top this part of it off, we're talking specifically cats and dogs today. For dogs, they are similar to us. In other words, they're omnivores. So they eat both meat and plants, and that's part of their design in nature. Out in the wild, they would eat meat. We would think of a wolf eating a rabbit, right? We would think of them catching an animal and eating it. What most people don't understand is one of the first things they generally eat is the contents of the digestive system of that herbivore. I know that. But the point being, they do eat both plants and animals. See, they eat the partially digested plants that the animal ate. Like I hate, one of my worst things in life is to see the lion killing the zebra, because I'm a horse person. I hate that. But that's what happens. They eat the digestive contents. They get the plants. So your dogs are basically, they can eat both, but your cats are basically, they're going to eat just the meat. So the point being, you can have rice, brown rice is better, or you can have sweet potatoes, squash, things like that. You'll see peas in the dog foods, but in the cat foods, you want to be looking at, it should be made from meats, and then it can have the vitamins and minerals and all those kinds of things. But you shouldn't see a lot of vegetable type things within the cat food. So that's a big difference between the cat and the dog.
That's a lot.
A lot. Yes.
that's a lot. So as we're looking at the labels, I know a lot of times I'll see the fillers.
Yes.
So many different fillers. Tell us a little bit about the fillers besides chicken feathers.
Right. Exactly. But again, you know, now in the pet foods, they're more similar to human. Another thing to bring up is that within horse, you don't have to list them in order of quantity. You don't have to. most manufacturers do because they want to say, hey, I'm buying the better stuff, but you don't have to. But pet foods and human, you do. So in other words, the first thing on the label has to be the major ingredient. The problem with that is, how many different names are there for sugars? Oh, like 50, 80, whatever. So you can say it has sugar and honey and separate them out. You can put something else ahead of them and then list 3 or 4 or 5 different types of sugar so that they look like there isn't that much, right? So that can be done with anything. If you want to hide the fact that you've got a lot of something in it, you just break it, rename it, put it some other way. But as far as things that are fillers, again, rice hulls are bulky and they're not digestible and they're cheap. The thing that rice hulls are used for that is good is that they're involved in medications and things. They have to be in a base of something. They're not supposed to be nutritionally there or anything. But that could be true of some good vitamin mineral type supplements that you need a thing to carry it in. You just have to be really careful because that might not be the case. So for fillers, we're looking at something that is cheap that they want to get rid of. In other words, they have an abundant supply of it. One thing you'll find within the animal and pet industry is that they use a lot of so-called byproducts of the human food industry. So if I'm taking, for instance, let's say I'm taking wheat and I'm going to take out the wheat flour and I will have left the wheat bran and the wheat middlings, which is the germ, and it's the most nutritious part. And I will use some of that. I will use the white flour because people want to eat white flour. And then I actually have bran, which is good and nutritious, but people don't want it unless they want whole wheat bread or something. And the same thing with the germ. So those things are actually healthy for pets. And we get them in the pet food or the animal food industry because of the choices of people wanting the less nutritious part of the plant. So that's why it's so fun as an animal nutritionist. We have access to some amazingly good, nutritious byproducts of the food industry. But then we also, if we are going to compete head to head, for instance, we want to put chicken in the dog food. We have to compete with the chicken market for people. So that's going to be more expensive. That's why chicken byproducts are the parts of the chicken that the people don't want to eat, but it may be the beak or the foot. It may be nutritious. It may not be something we would want to eat. It may be good for the animal or it may not. So it's a judgment call. Within pet nutrition now, it really helps to have someone consult to help you with your particular pet.
I agree. I mean, that's why people that care about their own personal nutrition will go to a nutritionist or a dietitian. And for pets, people kind of depend on what's on the market, hoping that that label is going to provide them with what is the best choice for their pets. Dr. Judy, we have to go on a break. So much information that was just shared. I can't wait till the second half of the show. And And we are back with Better by the Minute Live with Becca. My name is Becca Dukes. And don't forget to go and check out my website, betterbytheminutelive.com. There you'll be able to click on the air and guests and find information about my guests, including Dr. Judy Reynolds, where in this episode, we are going more into our pets, our dogs, our horses. Pets are so important when it comes to having a full life and having that unconditional love. Now, Dr. Judy, in the first part of our show, you shared a lot of information, and I know that you have so much more. Go ahead and continue.
Pets make people better. That's a good one. I like that one. When we're looking at the labels, and I'm not trying to make us all into experts at looking at labels, but that's one of the things I'm glad to do with people who contact me. I will go through your label with you and help you help recommend actual commercial products that are out there for you. But there are certain things that we do want in our pet foods and certain things that we don't want in our pet foods. Let's start with dogs. Dogs, as I said, are similar to people in that they eat both plants and animals. It is okay. We want to have enough protein, and they eat more protein than we do as a percentage of diet. So you may see 28% protein, 32% protein on a puppy food or things like that. You'll see quite a bit of protein where we don't want to eat quite that much as a percentage of diet, but you should see real proteins that you recognize. Some of the dog foods out there now, they will have venison, they will have beef, they will have salmon, they will have chicken. These are all good meat sources for your pet. We have to be a little careful when we start looking at byproducts because we don't know exactly what that means. So that's a trickier one. For the dogs, in order to have enough bulk in the stool and to help everything work correctly for a dog, it's fine to have something like rice, preferably brown rice, but usually it might be brown rice. And then common vegetables would be peas. Peas are great because the plant forms nitrogen out of the earth, actually pulls nitrogen. They're a specific type of plant. And so they have extra protein in peas. But then you can have things like squash, pumpkin, you know, just some of those vegetables that we think of as really good fiber sources, not the super starchy ones. What I don't like to see in pet foods for several reasons, I don't like to see corn because it doesn't contain all of the essential amino acids of protein. It's deficient in lysine. It is hard to digest. And there is an issue with corn when it's stored out in a bin or somewhere. It tends to pick up an aflatoxin, which is a toxin produced from a mold. And it can be in that moldy corn. Moldy corn disease can actually kill horses. So if they're fed a moldy cob of corn, it can actually kill them. I don't like to see corn. I work very hard to take most of the corn out of horse feeds. But the same thing for pet food. If you went back maybe 20 years, all of the dog foods would have corn as the number one ingredient. But now people are looking at more of a natural diet for a dog, and they're looking more for those high quality meats.
Now you're mentioning corn, and I know I have seen, and corn is supposed to be gluten-free, but I have seen on labels corn gluten meal.
Corn gluten is not gluten. Okay. As in the other glutens. It's a completely different thing. It's a byproduct. It's a protein, a specific protein in corn, but it's not even related to gluten. So corn gluten meal or corn gluten feed is when you take the corn apart. Corn gluten feed is very common in animal foods because it is very high in protein, but it's not a complete protein. So what they have to do when they use it is they have to add the extra amino acids to make it useful. But again, it's not the same as gluten. It's not the same molecule. It would be nice for all of us if it was named something different. Because now with many of us, including myself, wheat, barley, rye, and oats contain gluten, or gliadin is the one in oats, which is part of gluten. And the reason that we don't want those in our diet or our pet's diet is because that particular molecule is very, very big and sticky. And so when we eat it, it actually goes through our stomach into our small intestine, and it literally sticks to the lining of our small intestine. And that lining is extremely important because everything we eat has to be broken down so small that it can go through one cell in our digestive tract and into our bloodstream. The gluten molecules are too big to do that, and they're so sticky, they actually stick. It's like if you were trying to push something through and it didn't go through and it's stuck on the outside, not only does it not go through, but it keeps other things from going through. And so the problem with gluten, people that have gluten insensitivity, and the worst thing would be celiac disease, where you're extremely sick from eating gluten. What happens is your normal digestive surfaces are so gummed up, literally gummed up with that gluten, that you can even take vitamin mineral supplements and things and they don't get absorbed. When you have those disorders, you are severely nutrient deficient because you're not absorbing them. So the gluten issue with people, which I believe we want to continue on with our cats and dogs, and that's why I go for a grain-free diet. You can get a dog food that's salmon and peas. That's one of the ones I like for my dogs that is grain-free. Now, one grain that doesn't have gluten is rice. That is theoretically okay for both people and pets. The white rice is starch, easily digestible, raises blood sugar, but doesn't wreak havoc with our systems. The brown rice is better because the brown part on the rice, it's just like a skin. You peel it off. But that is where you have a huge amount of natural vitamin E. You have roughly 20% fat, and it's good fat. And then you have 13% protein. That was one of the ingredients, rice bran, stabilized rice bran, so it doesn't go rancid, was a big component of the horse feeds that I created. And I feed that also to my dogs and cats. Great question on the gluten, because that comes up for people who understand ingredients in animal foods. You would come up with that corn gluten meal and wonder why, you know, why that doesn't fit in that category. I don't like corn gluten meal in the animal feeds either, because really it's cheap. There's a lot of it out there. But when you have to supplement with the lysine and probably the methionine and other amino acids, you got to pay more to add that than to just use a better protein source to start with. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. And that leads me to one of my next questions. As we're looking at the label and it has that lysine and the methionine and those other amino acids, it's usually preceded by either an L or a DL. Will you tell us the difference?
Okay. If you look at an amino acid, it's a bunch of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogens in three-dimensional space. And they have isomers. It's like your right hand and your left hand are backwards from each other, right? They just label them in three-dimensional space. Now, when we're looking at vitamin E, the natural vitamin E is D, like D-alpha tocopherol acetate is a version of natural source vitamin E. There's only one isomer in the D. They're all the same. And that's the part that your body uses. Then there's synthetic vitamin E, which they basically put all those molecules together and let them form however they want. And you get eight isomers. You get the natural, the D, but you get seven other ones. And so when they label that, it's really synthetic vitamin E. It works. It's not bad. But your body has to do a couple of quick reactions and change those seven back into the natural version in three-dimensional space, okay? With people, there is a conversion factor of 1.38 to 1. So for instance, if I take one unit of natural vitamin E, I will have to take 1.38 units of synthetic vitamin E in order to go through that process to change those other seven isomers to the correct shape so that our enzymes and stuff work with them. I'm talking about vitamin E because that's the easiest one to talk about isomers for me. So you will see a lot of DL, all the supplements in the supermarket and everything are DL alpha. It just means it's got all 8 isomers. And your body has to change 7 back to the regular one. Interestingly, the work on naturally gets extruded from soybean oil, but it's not ruined in the process because they know it's a fragile molecule. And they make sure they don't ruin it. They take the natural E out of the soybeans. It just so happens that with horses, it's virtually impossible for them to do any changes to whatever isomer goes into their body. So you give them all 8, and the only one they can use is the one that's already the right shape. The other 7 can't use them. So all these years when they've been adding A, D, and E to the animal, the vitamin E to these, to horse feeds, like they do animal feeds, they put vitamin E in all the animal feeds. The pigs need it, the beef need it. It's for reproduction. It stops oxidation. It protects the membranes. It's like one of our best antioxidants and defense systems. Vitamin E and selenium are the 2 best ones, okay? But for horses, they would always say, oh, we fed them, you know, 3 times as much vitamin E, it didn't help. 4 times as much vitamin E, it didn't help. But what ended up happening is I noticed in my research a study on zoo animals where they looked at zebra and they used the horse as the control. You know, they looked at horses and they looked at zebra and they looked at a bunch of other zoo animals. And they realized that they were only getting 1 out of 8 with the horses. So we actually were the first ones to put natural source vitamin E into the horse feeds. And it made a huge difference. Now back to your question, when it says DL or D or however that is, it has to do with isomers, but it's different for each kind of molecule, right? So it might be good or bad. It's like the mirror image. D and L are mirror images in 3-dimensional space. And you would have to know if you were gonna look on a vitamin and it said one or the other, you would have to know what the natural one is and what the synthetic or what the other versions were.
So there's not a consistency of DL being synthetic and D being natural?
Terms are not always D and L even. So it's not that
sometimes they don't mention it at all. It's just
exactly like, in which case, but until research like that is done, people don't know. I mean, it's an accident that I saw the research. It was an accident when they figured it out. And it became a huge industry because with people, it's cheaper to buy the 1.38 units than the 1. And it doesn't matter. It works fine. It works fine in people. It works great in people. But for horses, you got to have 8 times as much, right? You'd have to put 8 times as much synthetic for the natural. So unfortunately, some of those things like that are not easy and they're not uniform. And so you can't, like you said, if it doesn't say anything, whatever the form of it is, there's a digestibility for it. But you know, like for instance, all the different forms that you can buy calcium in or magnesium in, or you know, a lot of these minerals, we have to look that up. And it's even not that simple because you assume that some minerals are not digestible when they may be. We use inorganic minerals to a certain extent. We can use them, but we probably need an organic form also. And what the best thing about the trace elements, not the great big molecules like calcium and magnesium, but these tiny little trace elements, they don't ionize. So you have to have them in a form that your body will pull through, will use. And you may even have something like people have heard about an ionophore, which helps a zinc element come in. So if you have zinc and it won't come through the membrane, but you put it in an ionophore, which is just like putting it inside a little capsule, and then that ionophore will help it come in. But the really key thing that I have found out recently is when you take the plant-derived minerals, which is what we focus on now, the plant has already pulled it up from the ground. It's in the fluids of the plant, which it would be like the plant's blood, but it's not red. It doesn't have hemoglobin. It has chlorophyll. But anyway, those plant minerals are very easy for animals to absorb because the plant already did make them biologically available.
And that's where the organic and inorganic comes into play. We're not talking about like organic food and USDA
correct. Yeah.
Certified organic. We're talking right. about the form that the molecules were either going from rock or they've been converted through the plant process and becoming organic. Inorganic right. means just plain old rock form, right? Organic then is when it's taken up through the plant's roots and converted right. into a form that is easily digestible and absorbable for a body, whether it's a human body or an animal body, it's more easily digestible and absorbable.
Right. However, we still need to understand that we do utilize some of those kind of rock-like forms. We can use some of that, just not enough to be as healthy as we could be. Nothing in physiology is absolute. Another topic for another time is that everybody thinks that animal fats are all saturated fat and that vegetable oils are all unsaturated fat. Not true. Everything has at least some of both saturated and unsaturated fat. That's weird, but it's a term you lie to simplify. And it's not meaning you're not trying to lie. I mean, that's just a quote. You're not trying to lie, but in order to simplify something, sometimes you have to kind of fudge a little bit to get the point across. But the more you dig into it, it's not black and white. It's not plus or minus. A huge thing, people used to think that elements like selenium is a huge one. It was either a poison or good for you. It had to be one or the other. And now we know arsenic, you need a little bit of arsenic. But everybody knows that's how you kill somebody in a mystery novel, right? Give them a bunch of arsenic every day. And so the more the truth of it is, everything is needed in a certain amount. There's a range that's not enough. There's a range, usually a fairly good size range that's really good. And then there's the too much toxicity on the other side. Even water, not enough water, you die. Get the right amount of water, you're hydrated, your body takes it in, gets rid of it, everything's great. But then you can drink so much water that you die because you need minerals to balance the water. You need your electrolytes, your potassium and sodium and things. You actually need those to get the water to go in the correct compartments. And that's why we have intracellular and extracellular fluid. We have the extracellular fluid, the blood and stuff that's mostly sodium, and we have the intracellular fluid that's mostly potassium. And that interaction, being able to open gates, open channels, and let molecules in and out, that's how we have electrical conduction, and that's how our body does metabolism. So we have to have two compartments separated by a membrane, and then we have to have charged things like sodium and potassium, and they have to be in different locations. And interestingly, that has to do with movement. So animals have that, but plants do not need sodium. They just use potassium because they're not going anywhere. They don't have to separate compartments and move things around so that they can walk away. They're just sitting there and they are potassium based, but they can use sodium if they have to. So that's a fun one. You can look that up through Dr. Wallach's professor from Mizzou, Dr. Albright. That's one of the things that he wrote about.
So you just said we need sodium. Did I hear that right?
We absolutely do. Here we go.
And so for those of you who don't know what sodium is, that's salt.
Don't go on a low sodium diet. It's not a good idea.
Because we move.
Because we move. There you go. That's a good thing. And there will be salt in the animal foods, and it's listed on there. There has to be. We put a certain amount of salt in all of the horse feeds. Horses are different because they get mostly forage, and that's what they eat. And we only have to supplement what's not in the forage. Where our pets get a food, and that's all their food. everything they need should be in that food. If it's not, we've got to supplement it. But if you think about it, a horse eats what 90 plus, hopefully, percent of their diet is the grass and the hay. That's their diet. But the grass and the hay, it's never got all the vitamins and minerals. It's never got the salt because plants don't need salt. That's why you have to put the salt block out, because animals need salt. Plants use potassium, but not sodium. So there's not an animal alive out there that's not looking somewhere for a salt lick. And there are natural salt deposits. It's out in the world, or we put a salt block out, or...
We use a full mineral block for our animal. Right.
And that's what I used to sell at the company I worked for, was a mineral blocks. And the main one for horses has 27 vitamins, minerals, and electrolytes. And that was a big deal because 27 was all we knew about. Well, now we know 60 or 80 minerals. And now I add those extra minerals, ultra trace and trace minerals, onto the program I used to do. And just for a teaser, if you would like your golden dog or your black dog or cat to have a darker, more intense color, and maybe not even get gray spots, if you add those minerals, you can change. You can make that gold richer. You can make a palomino darker. That's the research I'm working on right now.
And it's funny that you bring that up, because I just rescued a pup. And they've got real light colored gums, which is not normal for the breed, and gray spots. So we've had her for about a week and a half now. And my son said, "Mom, her spots are going away." And we have been intentionally supplementing to get rid of those spots, because it is a nutrient deficiency.
It is a nutrient deficiency. Yeah.
Now, before our time is up, let's talk table scraps, especially for our dogs and cats and our domestic pets.
I am a little bit unique on this, because I think the nutritious table things that we can feed to our dogs can be helpful. However, they need to be a small part, unless you're completely formulating it from scratch. I mean, I can take meat, I can take vitamins and minerals, vegetables and everything, and make an entire diet for a dog. No problem, right? I can take the fats off the meat, but I would still have to add real meat. The average person takes the stuff from the dinner table that the people don't want to eat and throws it to their dog and saves money on dog food. Not good, because those things are not balanced and they are not nutritious. Think about it. Some of the things that we don't eat, you know, we don't want to be giving that to our pets. And for cats, it would be a nightmare. If your cat is in the house stuck there, they have got to have a high protein diet, 32 or higher protein. Any little scraps of things that you would put in there, it's impossible for it to have the right balance. I kind of cheat on that because I know what I'm doing that way. I do want to mention of one thing though. Eggs, the most complete food in nature, bar none, because you can go from an egg, fertilize it, and in 21 days, you have an entire functional chicken, which means it's got everything, including feathers that you would ever need. You don't need the feathers, but everything else you need. So eggs, and the other cool thing about eggs are used in grocery stores. They will actually sell them for less than they pay for them to get people to come to the store, because then they'll buy other stuff. You know, right now, costs are high, things are weird. We have supply chain problems and things. In a normal situation, you can buy eggs for your pets, and they have all those great nutrients. And you can add an egg to either your cat or your dog, and you can do them raw. There's one thing about raw eggs, and that is that they contain an anti-nutrient called avidin that destroys biotin, which is a B vitamin. So what I do for my dogs is the glucosamine and chondroitin that I feed for a joint supplement contains biotin. So they're getting extra biotin, and then they can get an egg a day. And all the wonderful things that are in eggs, they get a shiny coat. They, you know, just, it's great. And it can be economical and it can be fun. Not saying you have to do it, but if you happen to raise chickens, awesome. The bad news there is make sure your dog doesn't know where the chicken eggs come from, because dogs will find the eggs by themselves.
Yes.
So that's just kind of a thing. And people, if you are eating raw eggs, people, you need a biotin supplement for that, because avidin in egg white, for ourselves, we want to cook our eggs very, you know, we want our yolks runny. We want our yolks runny or soft, but we want to cook the white, or else take a supplement of biotin because of that one factor that's in egg white.
That's interesting. So for our dogs, we're not supplementing with the extra biotin then. If we just cook them enough that the whites get a little bit milky color, is that enough? Would that work, or would it be best just to give them the yolk?
No, I would go ahead and I would cook the egg a little bit until the white is cooked, and I would give them the yolk runny, uncooked, because then they can use the cholesterol.
Yeah, but we don't want to fry their eggs.
No, I mean, the same rules that we follow for ourselves, which people may not be aware of that are listening here, is we do not want to use vegetable oils. And the main reason for that is that they go rancid. In order to be pressed and extracted, they get to 400 degrees once or twice, and they get such pressure that the fats themselves become denatured and we can't digest them correctly. Vegetable oils are not good. And I know people eat a lot of them, but vegetable oils are not good. And we don't ever want to fry anything, because when you heat something hot enough to fry it, again, you've denatured that oil. And our body has to take those fatty acids and go down and cut off little bits of the fatty acid and digest it. When it gets to a spot where it got all twisted and messed up by being frying, it goes, I can't digest this. What is this? So frying is really bad. Overheating is really bad. Oils are bad. So back to good old butter, eggs, milk. If you like dairy, if you don't like dairy, you know, I'm not going to argue with people about that, but dairy is not bad because of its saturated fat content. It also has unsaturated fat.
Well, Dr. So. Judy, I know you have so much more to share, and I look forward to our future conversations. We are at the end of our show for this evening. Folks, go to betterbythemintelife.com and look up Dr. Judy and get more information about her consultation services and what she offers and recommends for supplementing your pet's diet. Dr. Judy, thank you again for being on with me. Always a pleasure. I appreciate you and your knowledge and your willingness to share.
Thank you so much. I love doing these. And you may even hear my dogs barking right now, because they've decided something important is happening out of my porch outside my window.
Just in time. They're
guarding me.
Have a wonderful evening, everybody. And thank you again for joining us on Better by the Minute Life with Becca. Until next time, bye for now.